Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Mary Pieslick. I represent the respondents, Teller County, self-insured, care of CTSI. And I would like to reserve time for rebuttal, so.
How much time you'd like, and I can give you a reminder.
I would actually leave that more to the court's discretion. I'm thinking 3 to 5 minutes.
Okay.
So, well, really, we're here today to discuss a very particular statute in workers' compensation law. We're dealing with the situation of a volunteer and when that volunteer is considered an employee for purposes of workers' compensation insurance. Now, usually workers' compensation is actually quite broad. It gives quite liberal coverage to a worker in really when they're performing their job, doing any aspect of their job. But when it comes to a volunteer, the statute has been specifically narrowed by the legislature, and it has very distinctive language, which brings it into a small gamut. And basically, when you focus on the statute, you can see that the intent is for volunteers when they are actually being volunteers, doing the things that they volunteered to do, engaged in their volunteer work. In this case, search and rescue missions. Engaged in a search and rescue mission and in an organized drill, practice, or training necessary and proper for the performance of a search and rescue mission.
Well, let me ask you about that. Does the end mean, in your view, that it needs to be both actively engaged in the volunteer activity and in a drill? You have to have both of those at the same time?
Now, that's an excellent question, Your Honor. The word "and" is very confusing in the statute, and my opinion is that it is more of a conjunctive, possibly should be "or," because I believe it's, you know, you are either engaged in a search and rescue mission, or you are engaged in a drill or some sort of practice.
I appreciate you saying that, and I have to say I agree with you, because if you didn't have that, a volunteer firefighter fighting a fire gets hurt would not be covered because it's not a drill. And it seemed like I was getting a feel that both briefs and maybe even below that seemed to think you had a both, and I don't see, that didn't make a lot of sense to me. It seems to be either, it should, maybe should be or, so I appreciate your candor in that.
Okay, thank you. Yes, it's quite a long statute, and so it could just be, I don't know, a scripter's error. But we find ourselves here today because we have this very dedicated, wonderful volunteer, but he was injured not when he was engaged in a search and rescue mission, and not when he was engaged in an organized drill, practice, or training. He was, at the moment, driving in his car on his way to a fire chief meeting.
Well, the statute says duties as a volunteer firefighter or a member of a volunteer rescue team, but it doesn't really say engaged in searching or fighting fires. It just says the duties of that volunteer. And so isn't duties really conceivably a little more broad than actually performing the ultimate search and rescue or firefighting activity?
I would say no, because of the way the statute is worded. It uses the word "actually," and I think that emphasizes that the person has to be doing the specific thing that they're volunteering to do, in this case, search and rescue, or fighting a fire. So I think that it's actually fairly narrow. And the problem is, in this case, we have three levels of decisions, or actually two levels of decisions. We have the ALJ Walsh's interpretation of the statute, and he basically goes so far, in my opinion, as to say, as long as the volunteer is doing something beneficial for their organization or the supervising organization, in this case, the sheriff's department, then that person is an employee for purposes of workers' compensation insurance. And I'd submit that beneficial, doing something beneficial is simply far too broad. It's too ambiguous. It's would put the employer, in this case, Teller County, on the hook for virtually any activity that the volunteer engaged in. And if you go through the record, and you'll see one of the exhibits is this volunteer's curriculum vitae, their list of responsibilities and duties. And it is extremely broad. I mean, he attends, there's like 6 to 8 different meetings he attends. He's involved in grant writing. He's involved in just day-to-day activities to maintain the organization. So there's just an extremely wide breadth of things.
So why doesn't that create a factual question here along the lines of the Northwest Conejos Fire Protection District? I mean, you have evidence here, at least the prior sheriff told Mr. Smith's predecessor, you should go to these meetings, and that wasn't ever, you know, changed. So he's going. There's a custom and practice of him calling in to check in on duty, you know, marked in or whatever the words were. Because we've got all that evidence, why didn't that create a fact question that, you know, as to whether the man was actually performing his duties at the time of this accident?
There was no fact question because it was undisputed that he could not self-dispatch. There is no significance to the fact that he marked in. He himself testified, I cannot self-dispatch, and the sheriff department liaison testified, the claimant could not self-dispatch.
Sure, but you have, and I understand your point, but we have two things. We have, you know, several years before that he was instructed to go to these meetings, and then he started a practice of, you know, number one, attending them all, and number two, checking in when he was on the road, so everybody knew about that. There's at least evidence of acquiescence, you know, that the ALJ could rely on. So I guess my point is, it seems that it's more than just self-dispatching here. You've got this custom and practice and pattern for a number of years. And again, I ask, why doesn't, if putting all those things together, why don't we have a fact question?
Well, in thinking about this, if you let it go to kind of an acquiescence standard, you know, the sheriff's department knew what was going on, they knew he was attending, then you kind of switch the burden of proof in workers' compensation claims. Because in workers' compensation claims, the claimant has the burden of proof by preponderance of evidence that they were, you know, within the course and scope of their duties.
Right, but the claimant still has a burden of proving the acquiescence. Just saying that acquiescence might meet the standard isn't really saying that the claimant hasn't met their burden of proof, because they still have to prove that there was acquiescence, right?
They would have to prove that there is acquiescence, but it also makes the line too ambiguous for the employer. Then the employer is constantly trying to play catch up. What was this person ordered to do by someone else 3 years ago, and have I countermanded that? Instead of it being more within the employer's control, which it should be, you know, claimant, I want you to attend this meeting, I want you to go to this drill, I want you to go to this search and rescue mission. It takes it out of the employer's hand, and it puts it in the employee's hands, and it makes it very difficult to monitor.
Ms. Puselak, what is the significance of the term self-dispatch that you were using? And if respondent could have self-dispatched, how would that made a difference in your view?
Self-dispatch means that the claimant could make the call when he was on duty and when he was not. For example, if he heard over a radio, there's a, you know, people, a plane has gone down and people are missing in the mountains, and he just decided, okay, I'm going to go over and I'm going to help, you know, find this plane, rescue these people. That would be his decision, and he would, that's self-dispatching.
Well, how does that contrast with the term marked in service that was used during the hearing?
Again, I submit that marked in service really was meaningless in this context. I mean, maybe it was just a habit that he got into, but it didn't have any legal significance because he wasn't able to, being marked in service wasn't the same thing as saying, I'm on duty. Because of his inability to self-dispatch.
Yeah, or if it did, I mean, your argument here is when he says marked in service, putting himself on duty, that was self-dispatching is really what you're saying.
Right.
So well, let's take, I guess, back to the acquiescence piece. Doesn't the acquiescence establish the same facts as in Higgins? You know, where the Air Patrol guys flying to meetings, they were told to fly, they were told you're on duty from the time you leave and then you get in an air crash. I mean, why are these facts any different than that?
Well, the most significant fact that's different than that is that the Sheriff's Department did not tell claimant to attend these meetings. In fact, they specifically disavowed that they told him to attend these meetings.
Well, after the fact. I mean, we have, as I understand, and I may have the facts wrong, so push back. But I think prior sheriff told predecessor, Mr. Smith's predecessor, you need to go to these meetings. Nothing changed until after this happened. Then the current sheriff said, I never told him to come. He wasn't necessary there. Isn't that the facts here? There was, in other words, the current sheriff didn't tell him that he didn't need to go before this accident. Is that true?
That's true. That's my understanding, is that he didn't tell him that he didn't need to go. But on the other hand, he didn't tell him that he should go. So,
fair enough.
So that's a significant fact in Higgins, that the supervising agency said, you know, you have to go. And also the supervising agency knew that they were flying to the meeting. So in Higgins, they were flyers and they were injured when they were flying. So they were actually engaged in their volunteer type duties at the time of the accident.
Ms. Yusuf, you're coming up on the 3-minute mark and you wanted to save some time for rebuttal, so I'm just giving you a high sign.
Okay, thank you. I will reserve. Thank
All right.
You. May it please the court, my name is Cullen Wheelock, registration 9536. I represent the appellee, the claimant, Michael Smith, who was the injured worker in this case. I believe that the case law supports in Madden, the Supreme Court's indicated that they have reiterated that the list of exceptions for the travel status are not exhausted. I believe that we have met the burden on the exception of travel service, of travel status for Mr. Smith, because as the court previously noted, this has been a custom and practice of the president. My client was the president for 2 years. He had routinely attended the monthly fire meetings. This was critical to the preparation and strategy planning for a disaster in Teller County, which has had numerous serious fires. He testified, and the record is full of statements by both the claimant indicating how critical it was that he attend this fire chief's meeting, which was, and the record supports, a training mission. A training was going to happen at that meeting. In addition, the commander, Bright, who testified at the hearing, indicated it would be illogical or it would be ineffective for search and rescue to go to a disaster without strategic planning. I mean, I think we have to look at common sense. Not only did he attend trainings and meetings to prepare with different organizations, but it was under the mandate of Teller County's Office of Emergency Management and the guidelines that were set forth in my exhibit number 5 that indicated that they must have preparation. They must prepare and have a strategic organization prior to any kind of.
So is your argument focused on the organized drills, practice, or training piece of the statute? And if so, would you agree that the insertion of the word actually means that the volunteer must be performing a search and rescue or firefighting activity?
No, I think that you can't have one without the other. He either is at an event, he's doing an actual search and rescue, which time he cannot self-dispatch. When he is at a training, that is actually, I believe that it is, I think the statute would more appropriately be or training, because you can't do both. You can't be in a disaster and training at the same time.
Okay, so I guess my question is focusing on the actually performing duties. Do you think that that piece of it refers to any sorts of duties, or would it be limited to the volunteer-specific activities like search and rescue or firefighting?
I think it's specific, and I think that in Hagen's, it specifically says, they state that of necessity, there's a common link between the travel to a meeting was included in the activity by necessity. He couldn't go to the fire chief meeting if he didn't get there, and we're not talking about an airplane, but we're talking about a car, and it's the same analogy. And I think it is very significant that for 2 years, this man, who is the president of many different units and the unit representative, the incident commander for all of the search and rescue, the 53 members, that he always marked in service when he attended a meeting for search and rescue. And I do believe that acquiescence of marking in service, this is a very narrow, specific fact in which he always was allowed to call and say, I am marked in service, I am en route to this meeting. He was never told, you can't do that. He did that every time. And that is where I think it's important to delineate between his many duties, yes, but he always marked in service when he attended a search and rescue meeting.
Go ahead, Judge.
Ms. Willock, is there anything in the record that explains the significance of the term marked in service?
Yes.
Ms. Puslik said that she didn't think it had any legal significance. Do you agree?
I believe he discusses exactly the procedure of what happened. He calls to the sheriff's department, and the record it indicated that he said, this is unit 1301, marked in service to the fire chief's meeting. He was on, as in Hagen's, he was on a particular mission to go to a particular meeting that was for training. He had always attended it. He was on the agenda on a monthly basis. He had done that for 2 years. He had never been told not to. And I believe that you can't, what they've done is they've said, they've changed the rules after he was injured, but you can't negate what happened at the time of his event. He was not reprimanded after, and he was not told not to do what he did. It was only after he was seriously injured that they changed the policy that they have to ask permission for trainings and that's where I believe the difference is. And it allows this to be a very narrow fact situation. And I believe that the record supports a substantial facts. The record has substantial facts to indicate that he knew that this was a critical piece of training, that the county demands in their EOP, in exhibit number 5, it demands that there's strategic planning and training. And I really think this boils down to just a common sense. You can't be prepared for a disaster if you don't plan. And yes, there is no fire chief, but they had monthly meetings for all the EMTs and the fire department. People, members would come, and they were going, in the record it indicates they were going to have tabletop exercises with EMTs there at this meeting. They were going to discuss the coming, it was May 10th, they were going to discuss the upcoming fire season. And I think it would be against public policy to have a bunch of 53 men out there without any kind of planning. And my client is the only one who he was on the board, and he was the executive director. He was directed to represent and then transmit this information for planning to his members. So he was the specific, important liaison. And as the sheriff who testified at the hearing indicated, once again, I will reiterate, that he said it would be absolutely ineffective for them to just show up at a disaster without any plan.
Ms. Rock, let me interrupt you here, because I want to take you back to the statute, because you confused me at least and maybe surprised me a little bit. So I want to take you back to the meeting. So I think you have agreed that the statute would cover the volunteer either when, say, he here, actually performing duties as a volunteer, and I think you're agreeing with Ms. Puslik that perhaps it's really an or engage in organized drills, practice, et cetera. Correct?
Correct.
All right. So on the actually performing duties, I'm not 100% sure you were tracking with Judge Boris, but maybe you were. Is it your view that actually performing duties, that part, as a volunteer, means only that he's in a search and rescue operation, or if he's attending a meeting like this one, could that also be performing duties? Could those be his duties?
Absolutely. His duties are to prepare, strategically plan. That is a critical part. Search and rescue is only there to help in an emergency. They must plan, and that's why I've gone back to the Exhibit 5. The guidelines for the Teller County and the Board of Commissioners have adopted this plan that they must have strategic planning. And the ALJ found specifically that the training was part of the planning and the meeting was part of planning and strategy.
So actually performing duties is broader than just engaged in a search and rescue per se.
Yes,
I think you may have said the opposite before, and you may have misspoken.
Well, I'm sorry if I did, so. But I agree. I think that the statute would be more clear if it said or participating in planning and strategic meetings and trainings.
All right, so is your position here that Mr. Smith was both actually performing duties when he was en route to this meeting, and also he was involved in training because the meeting was part of training? You, in your view, both of those are satisfied. Is that correct?
I believe that, and I think that Hagen supports that the elements have been proven that travel in this particular case to a particular training that had been done for custom and practice for years by this man was included by necessity in the activity of the meeting, and therefore I believe it was within the course and scope of his employment arising out of his duties. And I think duties in this case are preparation. I think it's critical, and it would be illogical to think otherwise.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
No.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Wheelock. Ms. Puslik, you've got about 3 minutes remaining. So you have exactly 3 minutes remaining.
Thank you. Well, again, going back to Hagen's, the other very significant factor in Hagen's is that those pilots would have lost their status as volunteers in the Civil Air Patrol if they did not attend that particular meeting. That is completely the antithesis of the situation we have here, where the claimant, there were no repercussions whatsoever to him for failure to attend the meeting. In fact, after his tragic accident and he was no longer able to attend the meeting, the Teller County Search and Rescue didn't even send another member to attend the meeting. So that sort of emphasizes, you know, the lack of importance that attending this particular meeting held for this search and rescue. And no one is suggesting that the search and rescue, Teller County Search and Rescue, shouldn't engage in training and practice. No one is suggesting that. But if the sheriff's office doesn't think this particular meeting is necessary training or practice, then it should be the sheriff's office to make the call because they are the supervising agency. They have jurisdiction over this volunteer organization. So that's really just what I wanted to emphasize. Are there any questions?
No. Thank you very much, Ms. Puslik, and we thank you as well, Ms. Wheelock. We appreciate the briefs and your oral arguments in this case. They're helpful to the court.